The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
And if this is your first time listening, Unsound Methods is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
So first of all, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Happy 2022.
Yeah, we've got a great episode this week, this month. We're speaking to Keith Ridgway. We spoke to him back in 2021, but we're bringing it to you now. We spoke to him about his writing and also his lack of writing, his hiatus from writing and reading for almost a decade, and how he turned that around and came back to writing his most recent work.
Yeah, so he sort of returned with a shock, which was shortlisted for the Goldsmiths Prize in 2021. So it was a very worthwhile return to writing, I think, Vicky.
We touched on his place and location in his writing and how he kind of finds place and works around that and how central and important that is for his writing.
We also talked about not having a routine, as important as having a routine, I guess, depending on how you work. And Keith's sort of daily fight to get into the writing and to find a space for it. So here we go, Keith Ridgway.
Maybe start asking if you have any sort of routine in your writing. Is that something you would associate with or feel relates to your writing process at all?
My routine is a kind of daily search for a routine, if you like. It's I'm hopelessly ill-disciplined when it comes to writing. I'm very envious of writers who have a kind of routine and a structure to their day, and I'm constantly trying to find ways to impose that on myself, but I've never managed it ever. So it's always slightly haphazard. It's always somewhat on the fly, as it were, and it changes quite often as well, which annoys me, frankly, because I think, finally I've hit upon a way of doing things that is productive and efficient, etc., and then that collapses after a couple of weeks and I have to find a new way of doing things. So to answer your question, though, I don't really have a routine. I think if anything, there's a kind of what's emerged over the years is there's a sort of shape to my process, I suppose, to the way I approach a project, a novel particularly. And it involves quite a lot of not writing first, and a lot of thinking and a lot of just turning things over in my head. And then there seems to be a period of kind of beating around the bush, kind of edging around it, trying to get the sort of edge of it. And finally, at some point, I just kind of dive in. And then the actual writing then is quite quick in terms of, you know, a few months or whatever. But I seem to require quite a ridiculously long build-up to that.
And is that initial period of sort of ruminating, thinking about the project, is it sort of defined in any way that you kind of, okay, I'm thinking about this next project, or is it only in retrospect that you realize, oh yeah, for those months, all those thoughts now join up, but at the time I thought I was thinking about completely unrelated topic?
Yeah, oddly it's a bit of both, in the sense that I kind of clear the decks mentally and say, okay, time to make space for some new thinking on a new idea, new project. And I might have an idea that I want to explore, but that thinking is never, for me, is never a clean process. It's always messy. It always gets extremely messy. What I think I'm thinking about changes over time, sometimes in very subtle ways. So I don't even notice until quite later that the idea that I started with has now vanished out of my head, and I'm onto something else. And sometimes in very kind of clunky, obvious ways, where I kind of wake up one morning and kind of think, this is stupid. I need to do something else. So it's a kind of a mixture of those things. It's a lot of it is a kind of, in order to make myself write, I have to sort of pretend that that's not what I'm doing often. So a lot of it can be a kind of thinking about other books, or thinking about things I'm reading, and thinking about nebulous kind of ideas that are that don't become something solid or something that I could actually think of writing about for quite a long time.
Do you have sort of an image or a chrysalis that is the beginning of something that, you know, ultimately it may be you go in a different direction, but do you have any kind of starting point and then these other thoughts are floating around, or is it that there's no sort of start?
Usually it's something specific that gets me going, but often it's lost in the mists of time. But in this most recent book, A Shock, for example, I think the first part of that that presented itself to me as an idea was what turns out in the finished book to be the second chapter, which is mostly takes place in a pub with between two friends having a conversation in which one of them wants to buy a camera. And that idea of the camera and wanting to have a camera as a way of kind of reacting to or dealing with London in some way, that was a very early idea that was in my head for a long, long time. There are very quite old notes of that, of sketching out that scene in notebooks going back several years now. So it's that kind of thing. And it went through lots of changes, and of course, as time went on. And then when it was finally written, it's very different to those initial notes. But the elements are there, the two friends, the idea of buying a camera or stealing a camera, one friend being slightly startled by the other's reaction. All of those kind of elements were there from the beginning.
I mean, there's sort of lots of layers there of what is involved in that. Section of the book, and I could imagine different ways in which that sort of presents itself to you initially as a sort of visual image of the two guys and the, you know, the way they're sitting, the pub, so on, or the sort of power dynamic, and you don't really know the characters, or you just have a flash of what the characters are like, but you don't really know, you know, the setting or the background or the fact that it's cameras. Do you tend to have a way that the initial thought comes through? Is it something that would be visual, or is it more conceptual, or more just a raw emotion that you then have to fit into the characters? Or
I'm not a particularly visual person. I don't tend to approach things in a visual way, except very rarely. And I think in approaching characters or approaching something like that, I do it emotionally. I think there's something about that scenario, two friends having an increasingly kind of awkward exchange about what it is they want to do. And there's something about the tension of that that attracted me, and I wanted to work out why is this such a tense exchange? And you begin to think of the political context of London and the context of the kind of economic straits that both of them are in, and why is one thinking of spending hundreds of pounds on a camera, you know, and why would somebody want to do that? And the answer is that he wants to document in some way what's happening around him because he's sort of appalled by it. And the other guy, kind of while understanding that or feeling some sympathy towards it, also part of him thinks it's kind of ridiculous. And then there's a racial layer that because one is black and one is white, and there's something weird going on that where the black guy is the one who's the guy who wants to buy the camera, the white guy is having a weird reaction to that, as if there's something about his prejudices or his biases, even though that they're close friends, that makes him distrust the motivations for this. So it's all of that kind of stuff. It's nothing particularly visual. It's about all those emotions, about all those ideas. It's about the way in which two people would kind of juggle all those things between them and try and negotiate a way through it. That interested me. The relationship, I suppose, is what drew me into that. That's the answer, I think. The relationship between the two guys.
When you were working on the earlier, the not writing phase that you were discussing, where you were just sort of putting the notes together and thinking about it, for the latest book, was that all focused on that specific relationship and that thread? And when did you decide formally that it would be lots of interconnected stories to each section?
I don't know if I ever decided. I think these things kind of grow. I know that they were in, I was thinking about these two guys in this particular pub, and there are other people in that pub. And I found myself, you know, when I got bored writing about their conversation, sort of thinking about, well, what's happening at the next table? What kind of pub is this? Who's there? The political context was important to me because I was writing this and thinking about it and then writing it during that period of kind of grim, sort of fatalistic optimism that existed during the Corbyn years. And there was lots of people who I knew who previously had never been involved in politics who were suddenly organizing politically, were going to meetings all the time, and joining the Labour Party and joining Momentum, all that kind of thing. And I imagined that there would be people like that in the pub. And that kind of locked into it as well. And so my thoughts began to expand slightly, more than slightly, from these two people to the people in the surrounding area. And it's very much Camberwell and Peckham. I wanted to explore. I began to think, okay, this is good. I want to explore a variety of experiences of London at this particular moment in time and political moment as well. And to write about that indirectly in some way through the experiences of these people.
And did that lead to spreading out to kind of, I don't know, 40 or 50 different people that some then made the cut, some didn't? Or did it make sense each sort of step you took about the characters you were bringing in and whose stories you were going to tell?
Yeah, I was lucky that it was nothing near that. I think there was only, I originally thought it would be 10 chapters because why not? And it turns out to be 9 chapters. So there was actually just one cut. There was one chapter that didn't make it, which was about a young boy and his mother, and I just couldn't get it right, so it didn't go in. But anyway, the shape of it began to sort of assert itself then. 9 actually turned out to be a much more, for me, useful way of thinking about it, because there was this central chapter around which the others kind of orbited, and what I had originally thought of as the end of the novel turned out to be that central chapter, and the end of the novel ended up being back at the beginning of the novel, and everything began to make a certain kind of sense then. To answer your question, there wasn't a huge number of other characters who ended up on the cutting room floor, as it were. There was just one or two, and just one dropped chapter.
And that making sense of it, at what stage did that happen? Was that still in the sort of the earliest draft you felt that it needed shifting around, or had you really worked on the sections before you decided this is the central piece and this is the bit that works at the end?
It would have been in that sort of moving from the sort of note-taking and kind of jotting things down into the actual writing period, I think, where those decisions would have been made. But it's the whole thing is very unclear in my mind. I can't tell you exactly when those decisions were made, but they would have just begun to make sense rather than being decisions, I think. They would have begun to assert themselves as this is the shape of this. You know, whether you like it or not, this is becoming the shape. That would have happened, I think, at the beginning of the writing stage, certainly where the things were moved around. And it makes, I don't know why it took me so long to realize that starts at a party, why it shouldn't end up back at the party. That seems to make perfect sense, but it took me ages to figure that out because I thought it was ending in a different way.
Spatially, it seems that is quite important and integral. Not just the geographical space, but, you know, spaces, physical spaces within houses, within flats. Like you said, the image is not the first thing that comes to you, but how important is the sort of spatial layout of the novel to you? Is that something that you need to have from the start? You're imagining the two guys in the pub and you're imagining the table next to them. So presumably you're imagining a sort of three-dimensional space at that point in some way. It's different than a sort of, you know, Samuel Beckett abstract characters against a sort of blank canvas.
Yeah.
The space is a part of the story, and you know, you play with that in some of the sections in terms of, you know, spaces disappearing or appearing differently to characters. Is that something specific to this piece, would you say, or is the space, the spatial layout of the novel, something that comes at quite an early stage in all your writing?
It's interesting because having said that, I'm not very visual. Of course, I realized 2 minutes later that that's not at all true. And you're absolutely right that there is a concern with the geometry of things in this novel, but also in previous work to an extent. I do think a lot about the spaces in which the spaces into which I put them. I spend quite a lot of time actually sketching out little sort of floor plans of flats and houses and that kind of thing, and thinking about the pub, which is based on a real pub. So that was straightforward enough. But thinking about those spaces and trying to work out how the characters move through them and what those spaces feel like and what they do to people. I think there's more of that concern in this novel, perhaps because I was interested in the way in which we live in big cities like this, and the way in which we are sort of pressed up against one another and compressed in various ways, not just physical. But I think it's a concern that's been in previous books as well. And I've always done that thing of drawing little diagrams for myself of layouts of buildings and so forth. And I think it may be something to do with when I started writing fiction. I was very bad at moving people around. I had a character who woke up in the morning and I wanted to get them downstairs to breakfast. I felt that I had to write almost every movement that they took, you know, that they got out of bed. Well, how did they get out of bed? Well, they threw one leg out first and then the other leg after, and then they stood up. I somehow felt that if I didn't do that, the reader wouldn't follow me. And of course, this is nonsense because we are so used to characters being moved around as if by magic all the time. But it almost became a kind of a neurosis on my part that I found it very difficult to move characters around physically. And now, of course, it's no problem because it's such a dumb thing, you know. It's just like, it's incredibly basic. No one else has this problem, so why should I? But I think a hangover of that is thinking very carefully to myself about the spaces that people occupy and how they move through them and how they fit into them and that kind of thing.
As a reader now, you seem to play with that to an extent of almost going the other way and trying to sort of subvert the reader's idea of what the spaces are. It's maybe not always a clear cut sort of, well, they went from A to B and A's over here and B's over there. There's doubts are sort of raised. Where is B? Where is A? What is in between, you know, in certain sections? Is that something that's come, do you feel from having that hesitancy when you were first writing and going through this process, you now feel comfortable, or you feel a need to sort of play with those aspects of the novel? Or
I think what it may be is that I've become a little more comfortable about allowing that neurosis to show a little bit. I think it's something that I just find buildings and flats and houses, I've always found them kind of weird, and I puzzle over them. And I think it's something that crops up quite a bit in all of my books, actually. There's a novel called Animals, which is a couple of novels back, which part of which revolves around this mysterious kind of missing floor in an office building in London. There's another book I wrote that revolves around a kind of vast mansion in the suburbs of Dublin that has kind of secret basements and weird tunnels and things. So this has always been something that I've been slightly obsessed with, and it's always kind of bled into the work. And in this book, it's almost as if it becomes that concern or that worry about structures and rooms and walls and so forth is much more to the fore. It's much more part of the character's concerns, not just mine.
There's a sort of dreamlike quality of the missing floors and missing rooms and so on. It creates a non sequitur from the action, but then it puts that doubt into what's otherwise been described quite clearly in terms of layout and so on. it's interesting how the physical world, when you're dealing only with words, there are limits on what can be formed in terms of a physical space. Obviously, it's only going to be words on a blank page, but that can spring up in quite a realistic way. Yeah, it's just a phantom in the same way as a dream of a building that was only in your dream. It doesn't exist in the same concrete way.
That's a really interesting. It's a really interesting point because the buildings that I describe, the buildings that are described in writing, are constructed in the reader's imagination from the clues, etc., that are given. You can play with that a little bit, and you can make the. You can at least try and make the reader build something that doesn't quite make sense to them, or that is in some way discomforting or disconcerting. And there's a bit of that going on in this book, certainly. And it's that thing that I'm increasingly aware of, which is that the fiction happens in the reader's mind. It doesn't happen at my desk, or it doesn't happen in my imagination. It doesn't happen on the pages of the book. It happens in the imagination, in the mind of the reader. It's almost me trying to make something happen in readers' minds just by a sort of strange manipulation of physical descriptions, etc., that hopefully alerts the reader to something.
I guess you have to bear in mind the unique nature of that as well, taking that into consideration, but the fact that every single reader will be bringing all their past experience and sort of prejudices and whatnot to it. Is that whole thing about there's as many interpretations of the novel as there are people reading, even on that very specific level of how you're conjuring it up?
Which can be terribly, it can feel overwhelming for a writer. You know, what's the point then if there are all these different... But I think actually if you embrace it, it becomes very interesting and very powerful. And if you will, as a writer, if you allow yourself to accept that you're not in control of the fiction, that the fiction happens elsewhere and probably years and years into the future, which is something I love as well. And your control over it is limited, but you do have control over it. There are things you can do to a certain extent.
Into the future as well, it obviously takes on a different texture in that people reading today have certain knowledge or certain touch points that they can relate to. But even on that, there's different levels of specificity to, you know, you're writing about Peckham Camberwell. I don't know that. I've been there, but I don't know it overly well. But I, reading the book, I didn't feel, oh, this is a book for people that know Peckham Camberwell, and I'm not the target audience. I read about a pub, and I imagine a pub that I know, and it sort of fits with that. I wonder, do you find yourself sort of balancing how much to be specific on points and how much to create ambiguity? Do you sort of look at a sentence, think, no, take that out, I'm not going to name the road there, or I'm not going to be so specific, I need to make that more ambiguous, or the other way, it's this is too ambiguous, I need to put more details about the specifics in here?
With this book is I wanted it to be quite specific. I think I wanted it to be about this neighborhood. As you say, it's you know, you don't have to know the neighborhood at all, but people who do know it will recognize that, you know, the routes people walk make sense, and the places that they visit, it all makes sense. It all ties into the way things actually are. But it's odd. It's like the last three novels, which you, seem to have become more specific as I've gone on. You know, Animals was, London wasn't even named in Animals. It was kind of, it was to me anyway, obviously London, but it wasn't named. And then the next novel, Hawthorne and Child, was North London, but it operated kind of, this is probably Hackney, or is probably, you know, north, northeast. Nothing very specific, and this novel then becomes, it kind of zooms in to this quite particular kind of area of Camberwell and Peckham. I'm not quite sure why I wanted to do that, but at some point I completely embraced it, and it's what I wanted to do. I think part of it might have been the fact that there's been a huge gap for me between this book and the last one. And so I was quite nervous about writing this, you know, all the kind of anxieties and lack of confidence that you would expect after a long gap of not writing. I think for that reason, you kind of try to keep it simple. You try to keep it close. And I was very much, I think I took the decision to write about what was immediately around me and took some kind of comfort in that and felt better able to do that. And I think part of that was the naming of things. It allowed me to feel closer to what I was doing.
And was that quite natural then? When, like at the sort of sentence level or as you're writing, did it come quite naturally or did you have to wrestle with yourself at all in sort of rereading a sentence and thinking, oh, I need to add more in or take more out? Or once you'd made that decision to sort of zoom in on Camberwell Peckham, did it just sort of flow because you're familiar with the area and you didn't sort of think about it after that?
Again, it's back to me drawing little maps for myself and diagrams. I was doing a lot of that. I was figuring out, okay, where is this flat? What road is it on? But a lot of those very specific details wouldn't have gone into the actual text because they weren't necessary. And the extent to which places are named or streets or roads are named are very, very context specific, really. It depended entirely on what that, you know, what that section was doing or the atmosphere of it or whatever. I think sometimes anchoring fiction in the real world can distract. Just, you know, you're very conscious of that. You don't want to, at least I don't want to clutter up a text with too many details that would interfere with that kind of creative fictional creation that the reader is doing that we talked about a little earlier. So it's, I hope anyway, that I got the balance right in terms of these are specific places which actually exist, but imagine them as in whatever way you want.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Unsound Methods. We hope you're enjoying the show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods or view our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
Can I go back to something you mentioned a little while ago about the hiatus that you had? During that time, were you not writing at all, or were you working on sort of other things?
There was a long period in which I was not writing at all. I kind of took the decision to stop, initially to just take a break because I wasn't satisfied with the work I was doing. But that turned into quite a long gap. I decided to take a 6-month break and then suddenly realized that 4 years had gone by and I hadn't written anything.
Did you sort of check in after that 6 months? Was there a sort of thought of, oh, I'm still not ready to start writing, or the time passed?
the time passed. At some point, I kind of thought to myself, okay, I guess it's over then. I don't write fiction anymore. That's the end of it. And I didn't feel particularly kind of upset about that or anything. That seemed to me to be fine. But then what happened actually was at the same time when I kind of thought that, I then stopped reading. And that went on for about a year, and I really didn't like that. I missed it terribly, and I kind of had trouble getting back into reading. But once I got back into reading and began to read more and more and began to, you know, regain an enthusiasm for fiction, then the urge to write fiction of my own kind of sprang up again. So it was a slightly weird sort of period of backing out of fiction writing and then kind of very slowly moving back into it.
How long was that period in total?
Well, I think there's a 9-year gap between this novel and the last novel, and I would say maybe 6 years of those years were not writing.
When you went back, after the sort of pause in reading, when you restarted reading, was there any sort of reset? Did you just sort of pick up books that you were halfway through before, or were you like, no, clear the decks, I'm starting reading, you know, genres I've never read before, I'm going down a whole different route in terms of what I'm reading? Was there any change like that?
Well, it was one of those genuine kind of reading, it was a reading crisis. I wasn't aware that people experienced this. Lots of people experienced this. Something I've only become aware of since then, but I really found it physically difficult to read. Like I would sit down with the book and I could not do it. And it's something very, very strange. I don't know what it's like. And it was unpleasant. And I found that I couldn't read anything that I wanted to read. So I thought, okay, let's do easy reading. So I started reading sort of, airport thrillers, kind of cheap thrillers that you can devour very easily, and they have a very satisfying setup, and then it all falls apart in the last third, but that's okay. You just pick up a new one. And that got me past the sort of physical difficulty of reading. And from that I started, because I'd never read them before, I decided, okay, I'll read the Maigret novels, the Georges Simenon books. And I started with them, and they really got me going, because I enjoyed them so much, and they were just great. And from that, I kind of relaxed into reading his other non-Maigret books, and that got me into reading other things. And eventually, I was back, and it was fine, and I was reading whatever I wanted to read, and it felt good. But I can't quite explain the psychology behind all that. It seems to me now to be slightly alarming. But I don't know what was going on, but I have heard other people describe very similar kinds of experiences. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's something about the world as it is now or something that can do that to people.
One thing that sort of occurs is like the rise of phone. A lot of reading is done now, whether on phone or on electronic devices, and not reading a novel is a long piece of text, but the majority of reading, I would hazard nowadays, is less than 50 characters, and it's associated with notifications. And I don't know, for me anyway, I find that there's something disrupting happening there. That when my process of getting into reading a book is different than it was. It feels it's different, and it feels like there's some connection there with the fact that I now have this device with me at all times. I don't know, do you feel that there's any connection there for you, or is it other factors?
That's interesting. Are you suggesting somehow that our brains have been slightly reorganized so that we're less able to dive into a novel than we were?
I feel that. And I mean, it's a sort of nebulous thought, but for me it definitely feels there's some, looking at text, I look at it differently, and I'm so used to consuming it in bite-sized bits associated with imagery, and there's a sort of fast, quick, fast food sort of approach that, so not just social media, any kind of interaction, reading stuff on web pages and so on, it's never leading on to, well, this is a 100,000 word text that I'm going to be reading. It's at most it's a long read article that's 1,000-2,000 words or something.
I mean, I would hate to think that it's a general kind of drift away from the ability to read long texts, but maybe you're right.
Did you read? You said you started sort of rereading, or you started that process again with sort of airport thriller type books. Was that something you would have read previously? Would you sort of occasionally?
Yeah. I and still do occasionally, if there's one that sort of grabs my attention and that I think might be a laugh. It's a particular skill being able to write those books, and I admire it. I often wish I could kind of do that. It'd be nice, but I can't. So I don't mind those things. I mean, they're terrible. Don't get me wrong. They're full of awful writing and terrible characterizations and really bad politics usually, and sort of warped views of the world and everything. But you gallop through them, and they're like, you feel slightly queasy afterwards, but that's fine. It's, it's nice.
Do you think they have to be like that? I mean, have you attempted to write one with stronger characterization, or does it, is there something about the way that you consume it that necessarily makes it more flimsy? And
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't really know. I mean, some are better than others, obviously. And there are ones that are, of course, I can't think of any now off the top of my head, that I've read recently that I could, recommend to anyone. But I'm all for literature as entertainment. I really am. I think and it's something I would like to do more of myself. You know, I don't think I can write the kind of thriller kind of thing that I'm talking about. But there are other forms of, there are ways of entertaining readers that I'm kind of drawn to and interested in trying out. And it's about, you know, it's about intricate plotting and quick movement and all that kind of stuff. I'm all for it, you know. And I think the Maigret books are a great example, actually. Of, I mean, that's how you do it. But there's something also about the vast number of Maigret books that allows them to get away at times with pretty thin stuff, I think, because you know there's another 72 or whatever that you can turn to if the one you've got is a bit poor. So there's something that's a kind of a one-off kind of example, I think. But those are full of wonderful writing and wonderful characterization and wonderful scenes and atmosphere and all kinds of things. He's just such a great writer. But they are never less than entertaining.
And sorry to drag you back again to what might have been a slightly desolate and uncomfortable time, but again to return to the decision to stop writing. Did you make that decision kind of mid-book and you just felt this is the last, I'm just done, this is the last one? Or did you finish a book and just find that nothing in that thinking stage was coming to you? Like what led to your kind of deciding that you're going to announce to yourself that you were not writing anymore?
Well, it was, I had finished a previous novel, Hawthorne and Child, and that was going through the publication process, and I did what you're supposed to do, you know. I cleared the decks, cleared the desk and cleared my head and said, okay, what's next? And I started work on a new novel, and I spent a year on it or something more, and I never liked it. Even from the beginning, I never liked it. But for some reason, I couldn't switch to something else, or I couldn't put it aside and move to something else. There was something about it that compelled me to try and work on it, but I think that was a mistake, and I think that kind of exhausted me at some stage. And then, as I said, I decided I'll take a break. It wasn't I'm stopped forever. I'm not going, you know, I will take a break. But then the break became so long that it turned into a kind of semi-retirement. And so, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but it wasn't, you know, it was an abandoned novel, mm-hmm. I guess.
Do you think you might ever go back to it and see if you can resolve any of the problems?
So it's now, I'm now trying again, and it's, I'll probably re-abandon it in about another 6 months and not write for 20 years, you know, will probably be what's up. Now, I've gone back to it in the sense that that there's a very simple sort of initial idea to it, which then became, I was trying to work out what to do with it, and I think I took all kinds of missteps. So I've gone back to that very, very simple initial first idea and started from there again. And I'm more optimistic this time, to be honest. I think I can probably pull it off, but it'll be a very different book to this one, to A Shock, or to previous novels, I think.
Do you think that's part of the reason behind it? It's sort of such uncharted territory that that was why you didn't like it as such to start off with, or you've taken the wrong path?
Well, I think on the first go at it, I was not going into uncharted territory. What I was trying to do was take this weird idea and write the way I usually write using that idea. And I think that was the wrong thing, perhaps. So it's, and this second go around, it's taking it into uncharted territory about which I'm quite enthusiastic. So I think perhaps, although that's a very kind of oversimplified, generalized kind of way of talking about it. And it's much more complicated and than that. And I've forgotten most of, you know, what happened back then and what happens now is, it feels very different, I think, I hope. So who knows? But yeah, I don't think it's that it was that I was being too ambitious last time. I think the problem was that I wasn't being ambitious enough. And now I'm being too ambitious.
And that's what you're working on currently. What kind of stage are you at? What's a typical day right at the moment?
My typical day is tends to be me fretting about the fact that I haven't done any work yet and I need to sit down and find half an hour to do it. And it's not like I have an incredibly busy life or anything. It's but I'm at the, if we talked about stages before, I think I'm mostly through the thinking stage, and I'm at the kind of jotting things down stage. And I know that probably next year sometimes I'm going to have to dive into the actual writing stage and mm-hmm. just get through it very, very quickly.
You haven't set yourself a deadline for that. So we spoke to other writers who were like, right, on the 1st of January or whatever, I have to start doing this, that, or the other.
I've tried to do that in the past. Sometimes it works if I have very specific tasks to perform. That can work sometimes. But at the moment, it's just a bit too... It's still at the stage where I'm kind of gathering things in rather than have tasks to do. I'll get to the task stage hopefully next year.
And on a practical point in terms of how you physically get the note started, so going from the sort of thinking stage to the note taking, jotting things down stage, I mean, firstly, I guess, do you sort of stop yourself from taking notes during the thinking stage? Do you think, oh, it's too early for me to write anything yet? Or do you write the odd note down? And when you do come to write a note, how do you have a notebook that you carry with you everywhere, or use your phone, or is it post-it notes all over the house, or is there no method at all?
I'm a constant note taker. So the first part of your question, no, I would never stop myself from taking notes at all. Even in the thinking phase, I'm jotting things down, but they tend to be very, very brief things, not at all substantial. In terms of I write things down. I've begun to do increasingly in the last year or so is use the voice recorder on my phone. And it feels very Alan Partridge, and I'm kind of pacing around the place, pitching some idea to myself of what I think will make a great, you know, chapter or whatever. And I listen back to some of them and they're just awful. But I kind of enjoy that, you know, I kind of enjoy the sort of gathering of things, accumulating of ideas, most of which I won't use, but I enjoy that process. Also, when I record things, there's quite a useful step then when I have to listen back and write them down, which becomes a sort of, without it really feeling like it has to be, it becomes a sort of another filtering stage in which things become more complicated or more interesting. But I write notes in notebooks and on scraps of paper, and yeah, I do all of that. I'm not particularly well organized in terms of, you know, this is my notebook into which my ideas. No, the notes are kind of everywhere.
And do those those notes can be in any form. Could it be a fully formed section of dialogue, or a page worth of text that ends up in the finished novel, or is it things like two guys, pub, camera, tension?
When I speak into my phone, it's more like the two guys pub tension thing. but when I write down, I can't help but write as if I'm writing, you know, most of the time anyway. So it's bits of imagined dialogue. Sometimes I think of something that I think is funny, which 3 days later, of course, is not funny at all. But, you know, I'll jot that down all the time. Little bits of wordplay sometimes. If I'm idle and bored, I have quite what turns out to be, I think, quite a useful habit of just sort of writing randomly on a bit of paper, random words, which can sometimes turn into something coherent and something useful or something usable.
Yeah. And then moving beyond that, then once you've, I presume you sort of build up quite a array of different notes and different formats and different places, do you then collate them? Is there a process, or do you try to sort of pull the best bits into one document or into one place? Or do you just sort of go, okay, I've got enough notes, I'm going to start chapter one, sentence one, and see what comes out?
It's funny, because as I think I said at the very beginning, my process tends to change for each project. So I'm kind of discovering, at the moment, I'm discovering what the process is for this project. I have a lot of notes for this, more so than I think anything else before, because it's a complicated and, as I said, kind of ambitious sort of idea. So there's like notes in notebooks. And because it's something that goes back many years, the initial idea goes back many years, they're all over the place. There's dozens of different notebooks with bits and pieces. So I have had to spend a lot of time just finding the stuff so that I can access it again. And I was thinking of, and I have done some sort of transferring it and putting it on the computer. But I found that there's not much point in doing that, because then you're just looking at dozens and dozens of different files on your computer in different places. It's actually easier, I think, to have them on paper on my desk. And I've yet to completely decide that when I start the actual writing of this, the moving from the sort of note gathering into the actual writing, I'm not sure how I'll write it or what piece of software.
Yeah, you would always write on the computer. You never write longhand.
I used to, but no, I've switched to the computer now, I think. Mm. I think permanently. In the actual writing phase I'm talking about,
yeah.
Dive into it. The last book was written on Google, Google Docs. And it was very easy because it's a straightforward, nothing particularly complicated about it. It's just one thing after the other, and it was easy. But this new one is very complicated. So I don't quite know how I'm going to manage it.
Are you weighing up different software options?
You see, the thing about that, I do that. I have a terrible weakness for doing that, but it's entirely diversionary, isn't it? It's like, and I could spend 2 days kind of going, ooh, let's look at the features of this particular suite of programs. And it's kind of useless, you know? It's not like you need this fantastic technology in order to write a book. God's sake, it's just writing a book. So I think I probably have to go through that, sort of road test all these fantastically complicated word processing and collating software things, and eventually decide, it's fine, I'll just bang it out on Google Docs again.
Have you tried any of the software specifically designed for novel composition?
Yes. There's one I have here. What's it called? Scrivener.
Yeah, that's the one that people have talked about. I've sort of tried the trial. I've never quite got into, because you need to organize yourself in a certain way for it to work for you, I think.
I think that's the problem with all of them, is that they seem to offer you the kind of work in your own way. This will suit you. But actually, it's you working in their way is what it ends up being. And Scrivener, yeah, I've tried a bit with Scrivener. And to be honest, when I launch it, I spent a couple of hours, very happy couple of hours, but a useless couple of hours, kind of configuring the software rather than doing any work. You know, I'm quite content with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that sounds like a good distraction.
That's a day done, tick.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Another day at the office.
You can see why they're doing well with writers. any scope for a distraction for a couple of hours sounds, sounds good. One other question, I guess, moving on to the next stage. Once you've got a draft, do you read? You said you take voice notes at the note taking stage, but do you read a whole draft aloud back to yourself, or read sections?
I do that all the time. I do that with everything, notes and ideas. I live alone, so I spend a lot of time talking to myself one way or the other, whether it's reading or just kind of thinking out loud. I find it very helpful, actually. I spend quite a lot of time being characters, imagining how they would speak or the kinds of things they might say. Yeah, I'm constantly yabbering. I live on my own, but I think my neighbors think there's about 8 people who live here.
They know all the different characters in the novels before they come out.
Yeah.
To give them regional accents.
Well, that's the risky thing that you can actually do when you live on your own. You can kind of try out those terrible accents. I don't tend to do that.
Do you work your way through, so you'll have what we could call a first draft? We've had lots of debates about what we might consider to be a first draft. Would you then get that all together, say print it off or something, and start writing from that again? Or would you tweak it within the document? How would you go on to the next stage? How do you draft it, basically?
Yeah, again, process changes. But I think with the last book, A Shock, it was all done on the computer. I don't think I printed off anything. And I don't think I want to print off anything of the next book. I've taken a stand against printing, gone paperless. This is now a paperless office. It's not, actually, but I don't think I would print it off. But who knows? With this one, it might be different. We'll see. But sometimes I know what you mean. I have in the past printed off stuff so that I can, you know, take it out and go somewhere else and go through it with a pen and a fresh pair of eyes. But I find actually the better way for me to do that is just to give it time to go away from it, ignore it for a few weeks, and then come back to it still on the computer. But hopefully I'm changed and I can see things that I previously wouldn't have seen. So I try and give it as much time as I can rather than changing it.
Does the paperless, do you read physical books mainly, or do you read electronically mainly? Has that changed? No preference, just whichever way is easier to get hold of, or whichever way it comes to you.
No, my preference is for actual books, but I do get ebooks. I have a policy of I only buy ebooks by dead writers. So my ebook reader is just full of the dead. And all the books, not all the books, but most of the books on my shelves are by the living. this is a really dumb kind of way of rationalizing to myself that, you know, I'm spending money in ways that I shouldn't, and that are, you know, at least I think, well, the writer's dead, so they don't care.
And I think there's also, I mean, Jamie, you read more on an e-reader, I think, but certainly a lot of the authors we've spoken to that have, you know, played around with page layout and font and so on, which is generally a more modern thing. Obviously, there's dead writers that have played around with that, but in general, it's a more modern approach than sort of 19th century literature. They were not known so much for playing around with page layout. And I think there's a lot of times it can kind of not really translate when it's changing that format to fit onto electronic screen. Then you can fix things in a way on a page that you can't do and with an e-reader.
It's easier to hold a 1200 page novel on an e-reader than it is. I mean, I'd have to go into a bookshop and have a look at it to see if there is anything going on with the formatting before I decided that. But I think I read Infinite Jest on an e-reader, and I think that's the way to do it, because the footnotes, just click on the link and the footnotes are there. I'm sure David Foster Wallace would be disappointed to hear about it. But I've heard about people buying that book and sawing through the spine to make it three smaller books. I mean, that's that way craziness lies, surely.
I have just this. I'm about to dive into this thing. Look, this is Stalingrad.
Aha, yes.
This is going to ruin my wrists.
That's my thing. Every December, I will read a sort of doorstop book that I've been putting off because it seems to take up too much writing time in the rest of the year. It's not exclusively in December that I do it, but and I suddenly realize reading a physical book of that sort of thickness that, yeah, it's quite a workout sometimes. And it's difficult to get comfortable to read sometimes.
Well, December is a good month to do it because you can climb into bed with it basically and stay there all day.
Until life intervenes. You have to do things. Thank you to Keith for joining us, and thank you for listening.
You can find us online at unsoundmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsoundmethods or in all the usual podcast places. And do remember to like and subscribe, whichever of those podcast places you did find us.
Thank you. Yeah, you can find out more about me and my writing at Jamie Batchen on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchen on Instagram, and jamiebatchen.com